This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 48, and I'm delighted to welcome Ben Luckett, MD of Aviva Ventures, to dive into corporate venturing. What is corporate venturing, perchance you ask? One definition is that it's a type of venture capital whereby a company is investing directly without using an external VC in a minority stake in another company. The Economist wrote an article in November 2014 entitled, If You Can't Beat Them, Buy Them, subtitled, Fear of Being Displaced by Startups is Turning Firms into Venture Capitalists. Now, despite the non-stop bullshit slash fluffy bunny propaganda about FS as a whole about to be eaten up by a few startups, right now that seems quite remote. No matter what the self-serving interests of big consulting firms might say, and I'm thinking here of one of the most prestigious that recently forecast that fintech will lead to banking profits falling by 60%, it seems to me there is minimal chance, for example, that Zopa and TransferWise are likely to eat Citigroup for lunch, and far more chance of the opposite. So in the fintech case, I simply don't believe where The Economist is coming from. However, I do think a more subtle and more accurate point is that within the large oligopolies that constitute either banking or insurance, if you're one of these firms, you simply don't want to lose out to one of your competitors stealing a march on you. Citigroup management aren't losing sleep over Zopa, say, but they would be more concerned if, say, JP Morgan hoovered up all the best sexy fintechs in London. For the company doing it, corporate venturing is a classic route to get exposed to innovation in a marketplace that's moving faster than a large corporate can easily replicate itself. The Economist article spoke about Intel's venturing, which had over 20 years invested in more than 1,300 companies in 56 countries. Set against that, the HBR points out that the median lifetime of a corporate venturing project is 1 year, so not all of them fly high in the sky. For the startup slash scale-up, corporate venturing is a source of growth capital, but it can at best feel not like a type of venture capital funds, which can come with plenty of winces, as I see daily talking to fintechs, but as a steadier, less profit-orientated, perhaps, source of funds. In the simplified model, a VC, quotes, only cares, unquotes, about profit maximization. On the other hand, as we shall hear, a corporate venturing funder is aiming at several objectives. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining me on this rainy day today.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And it's even better because it's Easter coming up. I don't know whether you noticed, but the various Christian religions have agreed amongst themselves that Easter is going to be fixed in the calendar going forwards. So no longer are we going to be suffering Easter, which ranges from March to perhaps early May. However, on the timescales that religions operate, I think it's going to start in about 5 years' time, and I've forgotten when Easter will become. So what are your plans for this rainy Easter weekend? You mentioned big green eggs when I came in, but I have no idea what a big green egg is or what it has to do with your weekend.
Well, Mike, a big green egg is, for want of a better phrase, an American barbecue. But actually, it's
when you go inside.
No, no. So it's a large ceramic barbecue on which you can smoke or roast various joints of meat. So I'm hoping, weather permitting, that I will be barbecuing over Easter weekend.
I hope you've got a different weather forecast from me or somewhere I live far away. So is it like a Weber grill? Because I've got a Weber, which is Australian in origin. Was it a bigger Weber?
Yeah, good question. So it's bigger, but in the same way it has a dome, yes. And it's actually, interestingly, egg-shaped, hence the big green egg. So hopefully some of the listeners will have heard of them. I think it's one of the best things to come out of the US in a long time.
I see. So obviously you're a man with your finger on the pulse, which is quite good for the day job, because you've heard of all these things that the mainstream barbecuer like myself hasn't heard of. Not that I ever think investing in barbecue equipment in this country has got a great ROI. So in terms of your career, you've been a sort of company man for some time and had lots of solid backgrounds before you got into Big Green Eggs and being in Hoxton Garage, where we are at the moment, which maybe you can tell us something about. So how did that journey all work?
Yeah, so I started my career back in the 90s in consulting. So I worked for Anderson Consulting, which then became Accenture, and my focus then was on digital customer experience. So this was the early, I guess, iteration of fintech, where I was working with banks and a couple of insurers and working with them to understand how they develop e-commerce propositions. So I think this was what you called Internet 1.0. So we had a lot of technology expertise. Accenture, the banks, knew they needed to do something with the internet as it was. And we sat somewhere in the middle in terms of the function I was in, helping translate customer demand, customer understanding, usability into e-commerce.
Ah, so you really have seen it all before.
I have.
I was talking to someone last night, and they were at a one of the big four UK banks, shall we say, and they'd been around in the 90s too. And in the 90s, the big scare story was e-commerce is going to destroy banking overnight. And so this particular bank said, oh, we're going to set aside £500 million to, you know, e-commerce our whole bank and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, so they're busy starting to spend it, and the consultants getting very happy and coming in and writing papers and all that kind of stuff. People like you knew that. In fact, if I'd mentioned the name, maybe you could say, oh, yes, I was there. And anyway, before you know it, sort of the dot-com bubble, the Y2K hype, et cetera, all disappeared. And that rapidly went down the plug hole. So I think it's really useful having seen these things before, because you haven't got much grey hair, but you do have a beard. But the grey hair or no hair just goes round and round. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Or each time it's different, but each time there are some themes, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I do remember, and thank you for the beard-based compliment. It is obligatory in Hoxton. And yes, I can talk about where we are. But I do remember working for a bank who shall remain unnamed, around 2000, looking at a mobile stockbroking proposition. And in those days, the technology underlying mobile phones in terms of interactivity was called WAP. I don't know if you remember that, Mike.
Yes, Wireless Access Protocol.
Yes, very, very good. A very simple markup language. And they wanted to build a mobile stockbroking, what would be now called an app. And it's interesting because it was generally very poor in terms of any usability or any features or functionalities, because we had to use one of those old Nokia phones. Do you remember the ones the green handset which revealed the buttons as you pulled it down? But what was interesting, and you talk about things coming around, was that actually the predictions there were all around mobile commerce being the next big thing in terms of location-specific, time-dependent information like stockbroking. And although that never actually took off, the WAP-based protocols, what was interesting is that, you know, fast forward 15 years, it's all about mobile, it's all about mobile commerce, it's all about location-specific, relevant, targeted mobile interaction. So, yeah, I have, I guess, seen it all before.
So the interesting question, someone was saying to me the other day that the internet's had a rapid impact on finance, and I completely disagreed. And I thought the much more interesting question is, why has it taken sort of 20 years for fintechs to emerge and all that kind of stuff? So you having been over these sort of waves on your surfboard, why do you think it's really taken 20 years to come home?
That's a good question. I think there are a number of strands. There's obviously a big consumer adoption piece. So over that period of time, we've seen a much greater adoption of this technology, so people being comfortable with interacting. So obviously consumer adoption often drives innovation and the market for innovation and new businesses. So I remember when, I think it was HSBC first launched their online banking, I remember using it. You dialed up straight into the bank. It was some time before you actually went via an internet browser, for example. And a lot of the thinking, if I remember correctly back then, was about security, about how people would be prepared to access their finances online. And I think although technology moves at pace, it takes a while for consumers to adopt different modes of behavior. And I think back then, you know, everything was very new and the interaction model was very different. So I think what we've seen is consumer adoption changing. I think technology takes time to adapt and evolve. And actually, I think there's something more systemic or, I guess, cultural, in as much as I think the figure I saw recently was that almost 600,000 businesses started in the UK last year, which was a record. And actually, if I remember rightly, back then there was less, I guess, what you call entrepreneurism. Now, this may or may not be right, but this is how it felt. I think there were people expected to stay in jobs for longer. There was, I think, more feeling of safety, potentially. I could be making this up, though, in terms of people with jobs for life. And I think in the last sort of 15 years, we've seen a big change in the way that people approach employment and some of the barriers and some of the playing fields being levelled in what it takes to be able to start up a business.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I left Kleinwort's in 98, or actually it was no longer Kleinwort's, it was the Dresdner Bank. And not many people were crazy enough to go off and do anything indie in the UK back then. And as you say, it's changed. And, you know, these numbers like 500,000 new businesses last year, I'm always keen to deconstruct those into, let's say, for the sake of argument, 400,000 of those are people who are let go by efficiency savings at huge corporates.
Yep.
And then start their own consultancy, which is a one-person company.
Yes.
Versus your true startup in Hoxton that starts with sort of two mates from university. And before you know it, grows and grows and grows into, quotes, a real business.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in the role that I do see a real mix between those two types.
Right.
So people for whom it is the obvious next step post-university to do something in terms of starting their own business from scratch because they've had a great idea, and those who have spent some time in corporate life who have decided now is the time to take that risk. And I don't know what the stats are, but I think I see in some ways possibly sort of 50-50 at the moment in terms of businesses that are either in one space or the other. And I've always been fascinated by how a corporate background or a corporate identity or corporate skills can be translated into the startup world and kind of vice versa. I think we've got a lot to learn from startups, and startups often have a lot to learn from corporates, not in terms of, you know, how to do things at pace, for example, but in terms of how to commercialize, how to structure businesses, there's always a good two-way flow.
Yes, it's a very interesting point. I mean, when we were talking a while ago, you'd mentioned that, and it's one of those sort of seeds that went into my mind, and I thought about it, and I thought, well, actually, with hindsight, one way or another, I've been doing that kind of thing for 30 years, whether it's been kind of like an entrepreneur within a company, creating something within the company that didn't exist, or whether it's on the outside and then having to deal with a corporate as client or potential purchaser. So it's much more nuanced. And, you know, I sometimes get asked, well, if we give you your ideal job tomorrow, what size of company will it be? My answer is I've worked in companies of 1, 10, 100,000, 10,000, third of a million. I know that each of those models has got pros, each of those has got cons, and each of them has a certain feel to it. So, you know, there's no right and wrong answer. And then just very briefly, you know, mentioning the Hoxton garage that we're in, which is well trendy down here, and the symbolism of that and the impact of that. Someone cynically said to me the other day, so, oh, yes, you know, Aviva, they've got this sort of place in Hoxton, so they think they're fintech as a result. There's a cynical perspective. My own life, I started my career in a startup, which was in Bath University, Praxis Systems. It was in software. And then at a certain point of time, we moved into a lovely Georgian house in the centre of Bath, which then was very siloed there because Georgian houses got small rooms, and so the project split up into lots of little warring factions. And the management then bought a more modern office, which was large and open plan. Each of those three buildings gave a different behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't think it's, you know, in part of it is going to be symbolism being in Hoxton, but also I think part of it is it must, presumably, you're somebody who's been a company man for over 10 years, it must actually create a different vibe and therefore create different behaviours.
Absolutely. So two points. So just picking up on that entrepreneurship. So actually, although I've worked in corporates for most of my career, it's often been within ventures within corporates. And the way that that has been successful, i.e. getting stuff done differently and at pace, is to deliberately create a different environment. And there are lots of reasons for doing that. But when it comes down to it, this place in which we're sitting today, yes, there's obviously an iconic component to it, but more importantly for me, it's about creating an environment and conditions for greater creativity. And to be frank, if you sit in a lifeless office in the middle of the city, the environmental impact is noticeable in terms of how people decide to engage. The other thing that we've done is actually also recognize that we need to, A, bring in different types of people. So for example, our chief product designer, his last job was working on Call of Duty, the game, which I'm sure you play in your spare time, Mike. And the other thing that we've done, and this is what this is all about, is placing ourselves, I guess, literally in the heart of the fintech community, because we recognize innovation cannot be done from a corporate perspective just by sticking people in a room and hoping they'll come up with great ideas. We need to collaborate, we need to engage, we need to get involved. And actually, one great way of doing that is actually to physically locate yourself in the centre of the community you want to get involved with.
Absolutely. And it's certainly much more fun coming here than, for example, if I've got a meeting in Canary Wharf. So talking about engaging and getting involved then, as I say, from the outset, it seems to me that there are two particular faces to the corporate venturing coin. The first is what's in it for the funder, and there's the other side is actually what's in it for the fundee, the company that's being funded. So just very briefly, I mean, because I think most people are relatively familiar with this, what's in it for the funder, be it Aviva or Barclays or any of these people that do corporate venturing?
So for us, this is about what I like to refer to as the next phase of our innovation strategy. And Mike, it could have been us who talked about this before in terms of the, and you might even use this phrase, or corporate R&D. So for us as the funder, it is important that we understand and engage with, I guess, at the forefront of consumer and technology trends, and really have a deep insight and understanding of the impact that some of these trends and businesses will have on our business model going forward. So I know it's a cliche, and I know it's often talked about, this word of disruption, but we genuinely believe that there are some trends that will have a significant impact on our business model going forward. And by becoming an investor, one gets much closer to the market in terms of what I see and what the team sees around what's going on. In making investments in portfolio companies, we are looking to bring insight, opportunities, capability, technology, culture back into our core organization to do two things, really. One, challenge our business units in terms of their thinking so they understand what's happening outside, because the temptation is always to look inwards. And secondly, hopefully accelerate some of our strategy and some of the things that we want to do by leveraging those investments, do things better, quicker, and I guess more customer and technology focus. So from my perspective, that's what's in it for us.
Exactly. And just switching it around a little bit, it's a little bit strange that there sort of has been some sense in FS in recent years, certainly in London, of a kind of subliminal need to apologise by the sort of the large organisation, be it a bank or be it an insurance company, for doing this. Whereas actually, if you get out of the introverted sort of city perspective and look at pharmaceuticals or Toyota and Lexus or Intel, then actually it is much more par for the course in corporates in general to be doing this.
Yep.
So it's more than the anomaly that FS didn't do it, rather than, oh, it's a bit strange that you're doing this now, Ben.
Absolutely. It seems a very natural way of working. And, you know, FS companies spend a lot of their time investing. And although for us this is not a different asset class, in as much as this is not about pure financial returns in any way, I think, yes, there's very much a natural fit with who we are and how we act as an organisation. And I think there are quite a lot of apologetics, and I'm unapologetic around how I think this will help accelerate our strategy. But obviously there is the other side of it in terms of why would a fintech or any startup be interested in corporate capital?
Yes, well, let's come to that one in a minute. I'm just finishing off on the funder's perspective. As I mentioned before, typically if a company sticks money into an external VC's fund for something, it wants the return because that's all it gets. But then one of the advantages of corporate venturing for the corporate is that actually, as you were saying earlier, it can meet the multiple objectives. That all sounds wonderful until you're the MD or running something and you're supposed to stick the ball in four different nets at four ends of the pitch all at the same time. So what kind of multiple objectives are you going for? And just on a practical sort of management basis, how do you stick the ball in lots of different nets at the same time, as it were?
That's a great question. So in terms of objectives, there are four key areas, which is helpful because you talked about four corners from my perspective. The first one is the insight that I talked about, and that is not just post-investment. This is about, as I said, being in the market and understanding the trends, the technologies, the business models that are emerging and developing. So that's one.
Just to emphasise on that one, in case it's not obvious to you, it's obvious to you, but not just all of your colleagues who may be listening to this in future, but also other people at large organisations. As I mentioned in my New Year special, one of the most difficult things is actually to find out what's going on in the coalface. There's something of a war on truth going on in the media and the PR companies, or even on Twitter, kind of Facebooky hype around everything. The most difficult problem I find, and I'm in this world full-time, is actually finding out what's really going on.
Yes.
So there's a huge benefit of somebody going down the coal mine, going to the coal face and talking to the miners, as opposed to sitting in headquarters reading glossy brochures about, oh, FinTech Innovation 2016.
Absolutely. And there's a heck of a lot of stuff. I could spend all day, every day, reading, you know, fintech reports and recommendations. And
some of them are written on Cloud9 rather than from the coalface.
Yeah, so that insight is about being where the action is happening rather than, you know, a weekly digest from X, Y, and Z talking about what they think is happening. So that's really important. But it's all very well me and the team, and it's a small team getting out there, but how do we then translate that into insight into the rest of the organization? Because that's the objective we started with. Well, this is about how we then work with the business units across the organization to facilitate, transfer that knowledge. So I spend a lot of my time, in essence, with others in business units who are effectively venture associates, for want of a better phrase, for whom I can then help deliver insight by either introducing them to people I've met, to running events. So last year we had a blockchain conference. So blockchain is something everyone's talking about, but it's going to be important for our industry. So I invited some of the startups I've met to come and present. There was some dialogue, et cetera, et cetera. So there's events, there's conversations. Some companies in whom I'm not going to invest, but I think they have great products and services, I feed into the relevant people in the business. So there's this constant stream out of what I do, and to be fair, a lot of the other teams in the digital garage who are also in this space, of feeding back into the core organization, so they've got that regular flow of insight and information as to what's really going on. Look, we're not going to cover everything. I don't pretend that we will, but actually that has benefits in of itself, that people understand the external landscape.
Absolutely. I think anybody can understand just by hearing you talk about that there is an utter world of difference between that and sending around a weekly email.
Absolutely, Mike.
Anybody in fintech subscribes to a few weekly newsletters, and they're an incredibly useful service, and I try and make sure I read them as much as possible. Now, you know, I wouldn't be without all of them, that's for sure. But that's kind of just like a starting sort of sketch, and then you sort of hone in. So that's the first goal that you're meeting.
Yep. So just quickly going through the others. So there's obviously an element of financial return that we are looking for, but we don't have particular hurdle rates. So that's just worth saying, because this isn't a charity in that respect. We do look to make a return. So what are the other two? So one is about the cultural transfer and learnings, and what I'm keen to do, especially as we make investments, is actually to expose a greater number of our staff to what it's actually like to work in a startup. So most people in this organization hear about innovation and startups but have no real insight, and actually putting people into the portfolio companies at the coalface to then transfer those learnings back to our organization is an aspiration. Plus, if we make bigger investments, we'll put people on boards, for example. So there's a cultural transfer element. And then finally, and I think one of the areas that drives most value, is I see my investments as creating strategic partnerships of the future. And although we only make minority investments and I'm not into exclusivity, what I do like to do, and I don't do deals contingent on this, but the expectation is that we will work with that portfolio business on proposition development, co-creation, test and learn, etc. So that relationship becomes more tangible. And we can, as an organisation, and them as a portfolio company, jointly develop propositions, for want of a better phrase.
Good. Okay. So I think that's all very clear. And to an extent, we've almost preempted my second side of the coin, because the second side of the coin is kind of the mirror image in some of those, which is for one of your investee companies, what's kind of in it for them? And without just reiterating what you've just been saying in a different way, can you also say, you know, where it's relevant and where it's not relevant? I mean, you're not the kind of person who goes around and saying corporate venturing is the right answer for every fintech out there. And you certainly don't want to hear from every fintech out there, because your email box will be too deep.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. I think, so at a generic level, I think corporate capital is attractive because of that strategic return component. So we are not looking to beat up organisations or portfolio companies or startups on the financial return, and therefore I describe myself as founder friendly in terms of the way that we do deals. Then there's the obvious distribution and expertise angle. So Aviva in the UK, 16, 17 million customers, obviously a strong brand in the financial services sector, access to customers and distribution, and also to expertise. We've got, you know, 30 odd thousand employees worldwide, but some of the best brains in terms of analytics, pricing, etc., finance, etc. So at a generic level, there is the opportunity to work closely with an organization like ourselves and take both capital and access to those things that I've just outlined. Then it's on a deal-by-deal basis as to how we bring additional benefits to the portfolio organisation. And that could be from networks and connections through to the test and learn that I talked about, through to seconding someone into the organisation, to a commercial arrangement in terms of products and services. And there's a whole gamut, and we've only been going 6 months, so I probably haven't explored those full opportunities with everyone, but there's certainly, on a deal-by-deal basis, an opportunity to explore what working with us looks like. And you're right, it's not for everyone. We don't do first money, so the stage might be wrong. We might be the wrong kind of partner for what a fintech is looking to deliver, et cetera, et cetera. The people, there might not be a fit in terms of chemistry. So there are a number of reasons why it's not right in terms of our stage and their stage. But I think overall, there is an attractive proposition for corporate venturing.
Yes, and for the naive young ones who are sort of starting out on their journey, I always think it's like musicians trying to get a record contract. When you were a musician, certainly back in the day before anybody knew this kind of stuff, you just wanted to get a record contract, and then that was all wonderful and all that kind of stuff. But then a little bit later, as the decade goes by, you realise that you've actually been screwed over.
Yes.
And you can be a Jimi Hendrix, or you can be a Lemmy from Motorhead or whatever, and making no money whatsoever. And you think, okay, so I didn't just need a contract, I needed a good contract.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same way, there are lots of people in London founding tech businesses of all sorts, and what they think they need, and this is necessary but not sufficient, is money. I need money. I just need money for my stuff. But the danger with that is that if that's all you get, if you just get money, then depending on how lucky you have been, in a few years later, time down the road, you'll find out that the VC, or angel for that matter, you got the money from, gave you the money, and the money certainly worked. But actually, frankly, they're beating you up over the boardroom table every month, and you're rather wishing you hadn't done the deal. At the opposite end of the spectrum, there are, of course, VCs who are incredibly helpful and who make their portfolio companies work. And the same thing will apply in corporate venturing as well. I mean, maybe, you know, you don't have such extremes, but in terms of corporate accelerators, one of the disadvantages I'd heard about a corporate accelerator, this is generically in the tech space, not just in fintech, was that one of the problems of a corporate accelerator, let's try and pick an example. Let's say Intel's got an accelerator. I don't even know where it has, so I can't be commenting on theirs. You join Intel Accelerator, you don't do a deal with Intel, people look at you and go, so we didn't get on with Intel. They're a big, good company. If you can get on with them, why should I bother looking at you? So there can be a sort of a taint, as it were, if you sort of bounce off the corporate venturing. So in terms of wrapping this up, time goes by quickly, as it always does. In terms of Aviva Ventures more specifically, rather than the corporate venturing point, which I think is a very good one, I think it's one that's not well enough understood in fintech as a route forwards. I'd read that I think you've got, at the moment, a plan to spend £20 million for each of the next 5 years. So if there's an overlap between fintech podcasting and Aviva Ventures, let's have a conversation when the microphone's off, because I can help you spend some of that money on new microphones and all sorts of ideas there. More specifically within that, what kind of things are you looking to do? What do you need more of? And also, I think it's important on something like this, which is going to go out to over 2,000 people, what actually don't you want? Because you don't want 2,000 emails on Tuesday saying, can we have some of your money?
Yeah, absolutely, especially as I will be on holiday.
Well, I'll send my email this afternoon, so get to the top.
And thanks for your kind offer, Mike, in terms of the investment opportunity. Yeah, let's talk post Mike going off. So what am I looking for? So we made a conscious decision to invest across a number of strategic themes that are not constricted by both our current strategy or the way that Aviva is set up. And I think that's the mistake you can easily make, is that I need to make investments in general insurance or health insurance, etc. And I'm deliberate in that for two reasons. One, because going forward, we as a business will orientate much more around the customer rather than our products. And secondly, if I'm looking to challenge thinking, I don't want to be constrained by current thinking. So I've got four strategic areas, none of which specifically say insurance technology anywhere in them. And I'm less interested in businesses that are doing what we do today better, by making us more efficient or just digitizing something, you know, taking out an issue. I'm much more interested in those new businesses that are delivering something that's, I guess, radically different, that has a strategic alignment to what we do. So what do I mean by that? So let's take an example. My first strategic area in which I look to invest is IoT, so the Internet of Things, and people may not be surprised by that because that's a massive area for investment, but for us, quite significantly, the future of things like the connected car, the connected home, connected health, etc., are very important because they do have the potential to completely shift the insurance paradigm.
And just on that, for people who didn't hear the episode a couple of years ago talking about this, as I understand it, the point is that insurers can give you a better price if they know more about the characteristics of the asset that they're insuring. So, for example, if you've got a car, and I've got a proof that I've never driven over 29 miles an hour, you might give me a different price from if you put a little thing in my car and you find out that I sometimes do 247 miles an hour in a 20-mile-an-hour zone.
Which I'm sure you don't, Mike. Yes, so there are two elements. That's one part of it. So the data from devices such as the one to which you were referring, you know, commonly known as telematics devices, is important for underwriting and better pricing. And that does drive competitive advantage. I'm as much interested in that as the world in which the connected world, at least the sensor-driven world, actually changes what we exist to do. So insurers take general insurance. What we do is we fix stuff when it's gone wrong. Taking your car example, it's easy to imagine a world in which most of those things don't happen because the technology and the sensors have got to a state where the crash you might have had going at 29 miles an hour just doesn't exist because technology prevents it. Take the home. An example of, you know, a water leak is a good one.
It is. I just had one a month ago.
Oh, well I hope it wasn't too disruptive, but for some of our customers, it means moving out for a few months while we dry out the house and put it back to how it was. But in the world of sensor technology, some of those things will become ultimately preventable as we'll detect that leak as it happens rather than 6 weeks down the line. So I'm talking about a real shift in business models.
That's quite an interesting idea because I did have a leak, but I mean, you know, you've got these sort of nice wooden floorboards here, and as it's just before Easter, letting the mind fly away. If some company comes up with smart floorboards, which have got embedded in them sensors saying when they're wet, then actually I would have found out about my leak before it had gone through the whole bloody floor.
Absolutely.
And it would have been better, I'm not insured with you guys, so it doesn't really matter, but were I to be insured with you guys, it would be better for you guys because actually you wouldn't be asked to pay out a huge sum of money because actually there was a 2-inch drop of water rather than the 2 feet puddle which went to the ceiling.
And you've hit on it exactly, Mike, and afterwards we will talk about your insurances.
Special price.
Not appropriate now, but it's a win-win proposition. So for us, the claims cost is less, and for you, this disruption is less. So that is a very different world and is not that far away in my view. So IoT is a big one. For us, analytics is very important, and the two things are linked. So I'm particularly interested in AI and machine learning and the future of that world. And then the other two, just quickly, disruptive distribution, which is new models in distribution. So very interested in things like peer-to-peer. And finally, because of the way the market is changing in savings and investments, for example, we're particularly interested in innovative, customer experience-led digital finance propositions. So, you know, people talk about robo-advice, those kind of new businesses that are looking to disrupt personal financial management and advice.
Right. Okay, so that's very clear. I mean, just wrapping up on a point I should probably ask you at the beginning, which is about insurance fintech as a whole. I mean, all the hypesters this year are saying, oh, insurance is the next one to be disrupted. And most of these are written by people who don't really know very much about what they're talking about. And Stephen Mendel from Bought by Many was on about a year ago. And he and I had a very interesting conversation along the lines that, one, if you're setting up an insurance fintech, before you know it, the regulator will say, ah, you're an insurance company. Mm-hmm. At which point, you just need to follow all the insurance regulations, have a whole ton of capital, which ain't that easy. So that sort of rather closes down that avenue. The second one that I'd understood about peer-to-peer insurance is that insurance, by and large, is something to do with large numbers. If I insure your car and that's the only thing I insure, I either make a little bit of money from you all the time or I suddenly go bankrupt when you ask me for the whole car. So that didn't particularly work. And then where Stephen's coming from more is more about sort of the distribution or kind of, as it were, it may not like this phrase, but, you know, about being a new sexy broker, really.
Yes, absolutely. So
just finishing off on insurance fintechs as a whole, is that roughly right? Was it changing? Or
Mike, you're wonderfully well-informed, absolutely.
That's because I speak to people who know something, you see.
The complexity is often not understood in terms of both the underwriting and regulatory dynamic. The barrier to entry for insurance end-to-end is actually quite high in terms of capital provision and solvency levels, etc. However, insurance at its very core is only peer-to-peer at scale in as much as everyone pays in and some people pay out and others don't from an insurance perspective. So the economics are based around that. And in fact, we're 320 years old as a business and it started, you know, insurance started just down the road in the coffee shops of London where people came together to share and transfer risk. So You know, we are coming full circle. I don't think the peer-to-peer models are in the place that they need to be to fully disrupt the industry, but we're certainly looking in that space and understanding how things are evolving. But yes, the barriers to entry from an insurer, an end-to-end insurer, are still high, and I think there will be some time before that market is fully disrupted.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, Ben. It's been a really clear, rapid run through the corporate venturing and where you're going and the areas you're looking at and the whole insurance fintech. And I've always said this, and increasingly fintech is coming around to the same thing, that it's very, very silly to say small company good, big company bad. As I said before, I've worked in them of all sizes. There are pros and cons in them. And the idea that all the smart people are in fintech is a delusion. And actually, one of the interesting areas that you're working in practically, and I'm doing it sort of indirectly, is the interface between the small and large. And actually there, it requires someone who is, as it were, bilingual. Someone who can speak organogram.
Absolutely.
And someone who can sort of speak whatever they call dirty burgers or something in Hoxton. So thanks for that, Ben, and I hope you get your green egg out on what's promising to be a typically rainy Easter weekend.
Thanks, Mike. Let's hope so.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so grey, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. The city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.